yesterday, or last night, maybe I should say, we took a look at the teaching and training work of Jesus. That was our first session. Then secondly, we took a look at the works, the deeds of Jesus, noting the miracles he performed in regard to healing, in his confrontation with demonic spirits, in his miracles over nature, and just the sort of amazing, out of the ordinary things that Jesus did. So when we think about those things in comparison, I thought, well, what would be a good thing for us to focus on in our two sessions this morning? And I'm drawn back to something that I can't get out of my mind. It's the disproportionate amount of space that the Gospels give to the last 8 days of Jesus' ministry. You think about it, Jesus' life in its entirety encompasses something like 33 years, and we are told almost nothing about the first 30 years. Then the last 3 years, the years of his earthly ministry, we're told a fair amount, are we not? But even that record has it concentrated at the very end. In other words, by some calculations, a third of the Gospel of Matthew is committed to these last 8 days. Now, I'm being a little bit technical here. Usually we say the final week, but I was considering, we're really talking about 8 days. We're talking about the Sunday from when Jesus entered Jerusalem that we call Palm Sunday to the following Sunday, which would be Resurrection Sunday. And that's 8 days in its entirety. So these final 8 days, you could call it the last week plus one, whatever you want to do. But in these last 8 days, a third of the Gospel of Matthew is given to the last 8 days of Jesus' earthly ministry. A third of the Gospel of Mark is given to the last 8 days. A quarter of the Gospel of Luke and nearly half of the Gospel of John is given to the last 8 days of Jesus' earthly ministry. Isn't that absolutely remarkable? Some scholars say, and I kind of like this phrase, they say this, that the Gospels are essentially passion narratives with extended introductions. The idea being, what the Gospels are all about is telling us about these last 8 days of Jesus' life, and everything else is just sort of a good introduction to that. Now, I think that's overstating it just a bit, but it gives you the idea there, doesn't it? Now, of these last 8 days of Jesus' earthly ministry, the chronological details are interesting and they're disputed as to what exactly happened on what day of the week. The traditional arrangement has Jesus being crucified on Friday. An alternative arrangement has Thursday as being the day of his crucifixion. Now, it's an interesting topic, one to get into maybe at another time. What I want to talk to you about is the traditional arrangement. And just sort of to walk through it. First, you have Sunday, where Jesus enters Jerusalem on a donkey. And by the way, just for convenience sake, I'm just going to give you these scripture references from the Gospel of Mark. Obviously, for example, the triumphal entry is one of those events that's recorded in all four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But we'll just give the citations from Mark just for ease. Then on Monday, you have Jesus cursing the fig tree and cleansing the temple. By the way, I just can't pass that up. My mind fills with all these associations. Yesterday, we did speak about the miracles that Jesus performed in regard to nature. And was not the cursing of the fig tree one of those miracles? And are you not happy that the only destructive miracle that Jesus ever did, he focused it on a fig tree and not on a human being? I can't get the scene out of The Wizard of Oz out of mind where the witch is melting. You know, Jesus could have been doing that to people all over the place. But he did not. He did not. He came in compassionate love and grace. And the only destructive miracle he ever did, he did against a fig tree. As if to show this, I could do this anytime I want, but I'm only going to do it on this one occasion and against a fig tree. Tuesday, his authority was questioned. He taught in the temple and he was anointed by Mary. Then on Wednesday, there was the plot to betray Jesus. This is a little bit disputed as to exactly what day this took place in, but the plot to betray Jesus using Judas as the betrayer was set in motion. And then on Thursday, you have the Last Supper, along with the all-important upper room discourse. Now, to me, one of the most fascinating sections of the life of Jesus is that extended section through John chapter 13 through the end of John chapter 17, which comprises a lengthy teaching, sharing of his heart, outpouring of his soul of Jesus to his disciples, where he explains to them in remarkable detail and with incredible heart, he explains to them that he's leaving them and what it's going to be like for them and how they can be prepared to go forward. If there's any section of scripture that's worthy of just careful reading and deep meditation, that upper room discourse that Jesus had with his disciples, John chapter 13 through the end of verse 17, it's absolutely amazing. Then you have his prayer in Gethsemane and his arrest. Now, I want to pick it up at the betrayal, arrest, and trials of Jesus, and let's just walk through that together. First of all, we understand that Jesus was betrayed, he was arrested, and he was forsaken in the Garden of Gethsemane. We may be familiar with some of what happened there in the Garden of Gethsemane, how Jesus came there with the disciples, and that was a familiar place that Jesus would go, and he went there deliberately, knowing that Judas would expect him to be there. If Jesus wanted to evade arrest, evade capture, he could have very easily mixed up his routine and gone somewhere else, but he didn't. He deliberately went to the place where he knew Judas would expect him to be. And as he goes, he prays this incredible prayer, wrestling with God, his Father, and doing whatever internal wrestling was appropriate for the Son of God to do, determining that it would be not his will, but God's will be done. Not to imply that there was a diversion between the will of the Son and the will of the Father, but just to totally surrender the Son's will unto the Father. And then in the midst of that, that agonizing prayer, that prayer where it is said that he sweat, as it were, great drops of blood, which it's a little bit unclear, to be honest. It's a little bit unclear as to whether or not the sweat came off of his brow in drops so big that they were like blood drops, or if there was actually blood mingled with his sweat, which I understand can happen when a person is under intense pressure. The capillaries in their forehead can burst, but that's sort of another topic. In the midst of this tremendous agony, what happens? I'm going to read to you now from Matthew chapter 26, starting at verse 47. And while he was still speaking, behold, Judas, one of the 12, with a great multitude with swords and clubs, came from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now his betrayer had given them a sign, saying, "Whomever I kiss, he is the one, seize them." Seize him. Now, let me pause right there. You understand that this is at night. The moonlight would have been out. They would have had torches of some kind to illuminate, but it's still a little bit shady to identify who's that. They needed to get an absolutely positive identification on who Jesus was, because perhaps one of the very worst things that they could have done was arrest the wrong guy and let the right guy get away. You need to know who the right guy is. And Judas says, "No problem. I'll go up there and betray him with a kiss." Now, in that culture, as it is today in many Near Eastern and even European cultures, it's customary to greet somebody that you would honor with a kiss. You know, just kind of the cheek kiss kind of thing, but it's this warm embrace. And that's how Judas identified Jesus. Look at what it says right there. I'll pick it up again. "Immediately he went up to Jesus and said, 'Greetings, Rabbi,' and kissed him. But Jesus said to him, 'Friend, why have you come?' Then they came and laid hands on Jesus and took him." You sense the deep irony in that, do you not? Betrayed by his own disciple and betrayed with a kiss. And what does he say? "Greetings, Rabbi." It just turns your stomach just a little bit, doesn't it, to think of Judas in this situation? Now, what I think is remarkable about Jesus in his arrest was he gave himself up to the soldiers. He showed his power. The Gospel of John gives the account of how when they said, Jesus said to them, "Who is it that you're seeking?" They said, "Jesus of Nazareth." And Jesus said, "I am." And it says the soldiers fell over. You know, if Jesus wanted to escape again, he could have just kept saying, "I am," until he had enough room to get away. But instead, what does he do? It says in the Gospel of John, and it's a little bit subtle in the wording, but it's there, that he put himself between that arresting mob and his disciples, basically saying, "Take me and let them go. I will protect them." And that's what Jesus did. He protected his disciples in the Garden of Gethsemane. And he gave himself up to protect his disciples. And what did the disciples do? Well, apart from Peter's awkward attempt to defend Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, where he took out the sword and cut off Malchus's, what was it, his right ear, which I've heard people talk about this, and there's some reason to believe that this is true, that it probably indicates that he came at Malchus from behind, which is sort of a cowardly way to attack somebody, especially when you're not attacking a soldier himself, but a servant of the high priest. And Peter likely came at him from behind and swung the sword and sliced off the guy's ears. Jesus did his plastic surgery thing and restored the man's ears whole and was carried away by this mob. Now, where did he go next? Well, the Bible tells us that next he was taken to Annas and Caiaphas. This is in John chapter 18, verses 12 through 13. Now, Annas was by name and title the high priest. Caiaphas was in fact the high priest. In other words, he was the power behind the throne. Caiaphas was the guy, the older guy, pulled all the strings. Annas was basically his puppet. And so it says they come here, John chapter 18, verse 12. "Then the detachment of troops and the captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. And they took him away to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest." Excuse me, the way I explained it to you is just reversed. Annas was the high priest. Annas was the power behind the throne. Caiaphas was the high priest that particular year. And so they take them. And they question Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. And Jesus replies that they should ask those who heard him, for he taught publicly. You guys want to know what I taught? Ask the multitudes. I did nothing secretly. The Bible tells us that he was struck by an officer who didn't like the answer. Then he appeared before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. This is in Matthew chapter 26, verse 57. And Caiaphas came and gathered a few people from the Sanhedrin there at that particular place. It says there, starting at verse 57 in Matthew 26, "And those who had laid hold of Jesus led him away to Caiaphas the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance to the high priest's courtyard. And he went in and sat with the servants to see the end. Now the chief priests, the elders, and the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death and found none. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they found none. But at least two false witnesses came forward." You know what I think is fascinating about these several different trials they had? Because you see that he actually had a series of appearances before Annas, before Caiaphas, before the Sanhedrin after daybreak that we're going to take a look at just a minute. When you put these together, I am reminded of the suggestion of the Passover lamb. Now, you know that this Passover lamb that would be sacrificed was a picture, a type, so to speak, of Jesus and his sacrifice. Matter of fact, John the Baptist, when he first saw Jesus in his ministry, what did he proclaim? "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." And what was essential for a Passover lamb or any animal to have happen to it before it be sacrificed? It had to be examined. It had to be examined by the priests. And here I see very much Jesus, the Passover lamb, is being examined by the priests, and he'll be examined by Pilate, and it's going to be determined that he's sinless. They'll have no rightful charge to pin upon him. If he has any accusers, they're false witnesses. They'll contradict each other. You'll have is what Pilate declares, that we'll see in a few moments. But notice this, Jesus, the Passover lamb, was inspected by the priests and the religious leaders, and he was determined to be pure and ready for sacrifice. Matter of fact, as the false witness contradicted each other, Jesus answered nothing. He kept silent when he could have offered a brilliant defense. Have you ever thought about the defense that Jesus could have offered at this trial before the religious officials? Your Honor, I'd like to bring in Exhibit A man born blind. Exhibit B, a man I healed at the Pool of Bethesda. Exhibit C, a woman out of whom I cast out seven demons. Your Honor, I'd like to bring Isaiah to the stand. I'd like to bring Moses to the stand. All of these will testify of me. I'd like to bring the disciples of John the Baptist to the stand, and they will describe for us what the teaching of John the Baptist was and how he was my form. Can you imagine the amazing trial scene it could have been if Jesus were interested in offering a defense? But he made no defense. He was silent. His one word during this trial is recorded to us in several Gospels. I'm going to read it to you from Mark chapter 14. His one word during this trial was this. Mark 14:62 says this. Jesus, he was accused of being the Son of God. And this is how he responded. I am. And you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. What a word. That's not a defense. That's a simple proclamation. You want to know if I'm the Son of God? I am. And right now you sit in judgment of me. One day I'm going to sit in judgment of you. Be careful with what you do here. That was Jesus' message to them. What a bold, amazing message. Now, for all of this, Jesus was condemned, beaten, and mocked. And what I find amazing about the gospel accounts here is how it tells us that the members of the Sanhedrin, now, the members of the Sanhedrin, remember, these are esteemed men in the society. This is something like, members of a legislature, members of Congress, political and religious officials. This is like the board of a major denomination. You know, these are men who are, these are the suit and tie guys. These are the guys who, you know, they've got dignity. They're official. They're all of that. And it tells us that the members of the Sanhedrin spat upon Jesus. That they beat him and they commanded him to be beaten. That they slapped his face and said to him, prophesy to us, Christ, who's the one who struck you? It shows you how easily we descend into madness when we reject Jesus Christ. Now, after daybreak, the Sanhedrin met again to ratify the outcome of the previous night's trial. That's why it says in Luke chapter 22, as soon as it was day, the elders of the people, both chief priests and scribes, came together and led him into their council, saying, if you are the Christ, tell us. But he said to them, if I tell you, you will by no means believe. You see, the other important dynamic to consider about the trial of Jesus was that in the whole, it went against the amazing legal protections that were afforded in the Jewish system of law. The Jewish system of law was one of the most advanced, you would say, on the earth, especially in regard to the rights of the accused. They had many protections within Jewish law that protected the rights of the accused. For example, you couldn't have a trial at night. It had to be in daylight when everybody could see what was going on. If there was going to be a sentence of death made, the judge had to wait until the next day to officially pronounce it to allow for the feelings of mercy to come up, if they should come up in his heart. The accused had the right to cross-examine his accusers, on and on. Amazing protections. So many of these protections for the accused were thrown out of the window, and that's why they had to have this second trial, or really a continuation of the trial, after daybreak. It says, after daybreak they did this. And then Jesus said, if I tell you, you'll by no means believe. Now, after this series of appearances before the religious officials, then Jesus appeared before the state, the government officials, most pointedly Pontius Pilate. John chapter 18, starting at verse 33, tells us about his first appearance before Pontius Pilate. And again, I have to control myself because I think that Pontius Pilate is this amazing individual. The picture we have of Pontius Pilate in secular history, because we have writings that mention Pontius Pilate and some of the things he did, especially in Josephus. The picture we have of Pontius Pilate from secular history and the picture we have him of him in the Gospels, they don't exactly match. And when I say don't exactly, I don't mean that they're contradictory, but you can tell the Pilate displayed for us in the Gospels is troubled. Brothers and sisters, Pontius Pilate was a ruthless, bloodthirsty man. We know from Josephus' history that he would command the execution of dozens without a second thought. Just do it. Life was cheap in the eyes of Pontius Pilate. And Jewish life was even cheaper. And Pilate would be pretty quick to pull the trigger upon anybody who had threatened the stability of the Roman occupation there in Roman-occupied Judea. So why does he seem so conflicted? Why does he seem so troubled by the case of Jesus? It's because he never had anybody stand before him like Jesus before. Can you imagine all the men who stood before Pontius Pilate, groveling, begging for their life? Can you imagine all the men who appeared before Pontius Pilate? And let's be honest, most of the men who ever came to Pontius Pilate for judgment, especially most of the Jewish men that came to Pontius Pilate for judgment, they were bad men. They were assassins. They were terrorists. They were people in the resistance movement against the Romans as they occupied. And Pilate knew what those guys were like. He looked into so many of those faces that he could read them. He could see it. I know you. Matter of fact, Pilate would probably say, I know you because I'm something like you. For you, life is cheap in the pursuit of your cause, and it's the same way with me. We have a common bond. But when Pontius Pilate looked at Jesus Christ, he saw somebody completely different from himself. I think it absolutely blew the mind of Pontius Pilate when he looked into the face of Jesus and saw no fear whatsoever. That countenance of Jesus that said, you can do nothing to me that is outside the plan of God. That look on the face of Jesus that said, I am not afraid of you. If anything, you should be afraid of me. What a stunning thing. So it's interesting, but not surprising, that the Pilate we see in the Gospels as he deals with Jesus doesn't look just like the Pilate we see in secular history. Now let me read to you. John chapter 18, starting at verse 33. Then Pilate entered the praetorium again, called Jesus, and said to him, are you the king of the Jews? Jesus answered him, are you speaking for yourself about this? Or did others tell you this concerning me? Pilate answered, am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests has delivered you to me. What have you done? Now, this is a little bit more like the Pilate we see in secular history. All business. Who are you? What have you done? This is what you're accused of. Confess your crime. I got ways of making you confess. I've done this 100 times before. Who are you? Confess your crime before me. You might die a more merciful death. In response, Jesus told Pontius Pilate that he was a king, but his kingdom was not of this world. It was a kingdom of truth. Pilate replied cynically, and he said these words, "I find no guilt in him." Now make no mistake about it. Jesus was the accused appearing before Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate was his judge. He was the Roman governor. When the judge says to the accused, "I find no guilt in him," what does that mean? Or at least I should say, what should it mean? It should mean trial's over. You could go home. Thank the bailiff on your way out. That's what it should mean. But that's not what it meant in this case. But Pilate declared it. And then he heard, I think this is in the Gospel of Luke, he heard that Jesus was a Galilean. And then we see Pilate starting to act more and more out of character from how we know him in secular history. When he heard that Jesus was a Galilean, he said, "Fantastic, Herod, who rules over the region of Galilee." Now, this is a little bit complicated. The Romans divided their empire into all kinds of provinces and this and that. And there was occupied Judea, which wasn't technically a province on the same level as other Roman provinces. So Pilate was not technically a governor. I think his title was procurator, which was a different kind of official over it. Essentially, he was the governor, but it was a specific title suitable for that region. Now, that region that Pilate governed over did not extend to the region of Galilee. That was reigned over by one of the sub-kings who was a descendant of King Herod. He was known as Herod Antipas. And this particular Herod was basically what they call a vassal king of Rome. They said to Herod, "Yeah, you can keep the title king. You want to wear your crown? Who cares? We don't care. But we all agree, you really answer to Caesar." And he said, "You better believe I understand that. I won't do anything bad to Caesar. Just let me wear my crown." They said, "Great, you can do it." So this was Herod. Pilate heard that Jesus was a Galilean, and he says, "Fantastic, send him to Herod." So he was taken to Herod. This is in Luke chapter 23, verses 7 and 8. It says, "As soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. Now when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceedingly glad, for he had desired a long time to see him because he had heard many things about him, and he hoped to see some miracle done by him." Jesus's appearance before Herod is fascinating because basically Herod said to Jesus, "Oh, swell, I've been wanting to meet you a long time. Hey, do me some tricks. Man, I've heard you do amazing stuff. Cool, come on, come up with some of it. I'm right here. You're here, I'm here. Work me some miracles. I'd love to see them." We do not have record of a single word that Jesus said to Herod. I can imagine just Jesus looking at him in a strange mix of compassion and desperation, saying, "You poor, lost man. You have no idea who you are or what life is for or what anything is about." Jesus refused to speak a single word to Herod. So what did Herod do? Send him back to Pontius Pilate. Now, poor Pilate, he thought he had got this mess off of his hands. But they bring Jesus back to Pontius Pilate, and then we pick it up here in John chapter 19, verse 1. "So then Pilate took Jesus and scourged him. And the soldiers twisted a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they put on him a purple robe. Then they said, 'Hail, King of the Jews!' And they struck him with their hands. Pilate then went out again and said to them, 'Behold, I'm bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no fault in him.'" Can I pause just right there for a moment? What does it mean when the judge says over the accused, "I find no fault in him"? It should mean the accused goes home right then and there. But then it says, "Then Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. And Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." What an amazing scene. There's a mob there, whipped up by the religious leaders. There's the Roman soldiers there. There's whatever government officials there. Jerusalem's crowded at this time. It's the Passover. And Pilate, before whatever crowd is there, after Jesus is beaten, after he's mocked, after the crown of thorns is pressed upon his head, after all that is done, what does he do? He presents Jesus before that crowd. "Look at this man. I believe that what Pilate wanted to do was hope to arouse a sense of pity in the crowd. Look at this man. Hasn't he suffered enough? You know and I know he hasn't done anything worthy of this. Isn't this enough?" The Bible tells us that the crowd just simply chanted, "Crucify him, crucify him." And I'm not going to get into the whole Barabbas thing. It's fascinating, but that works all in here. Pilate hoping for another excuse to release Jesus, with the custom of exchanging one prisoner or releasing one prisoner at the time of Passover. That doesn't work either. So at the end of it all, Mark chapter 15, verse 15, Pilate sentenced Jesus to death. So Pilate, wanting to gratify the crowd, released Barabbas to them. And he delivered Jesus, after he had scourged him, to be crucified. Now, we're told in some kind of depth what they did to Jesus. And the fascinating thing about the beating and the mocking that they put upon Jesus was just how gratuitous it was. Was there any reason legally, morally, to treat this man this way? Was there any reason for the soldiers to play games with him? Was there any reason for the soldiers to pretend to worship him? To press that crown of thorns, to dress him in the purple robe, to give him a weak stick, a reed, and say, "Well, that's your scepter." Was there any reason? We even hear in the Gospels that they took the reed that was in his hand, they grabbed it, which again would have been something like a soft stick, they grabbed it, and they start smacking him on the head with it. Some of it was deliberately meant to injure Jesus. Other aspects were just meant to mock him, to insult him to the highest degree possible. Now, all this is before Jesus is nailed to the cross. And I can't help but remember that this says something so profound, not only about the love and the strength of Jesus. Because are we not stunned by that? Do we not agree that Jesus, being God, had the power of retaliation right then and there? And I don't know of human beings who would have the power, the ability to retaliate, to defend oneself. The ability to, with a thought of his mind, call down a legion of angels who I'm sure were on alert in heaven and ready to go at any time. He had the ability to do that, but he did not do it. So what it says about Jesus is amazing, but I also can't get away from the thought of what this says about humanity. Now look, we all like to think, well, if I was there, I wouldn't have done this. Brothers and sisters, there's something very crazy about a mob mentality. People in a mob will do things collectively that they would never do individually. And this small mob of soldiers and the larger mob that was condemning Jesus, they showed not only the depth of Jesus' love and strength, but they also showed the depravity of humanity. It wasn't enough for us to crucify the Son of God. We, and I'm speaking of us collectively as humanity, we didn't stop at just crucifying. We had to make a game out of it. We had to mock him all along the way. We had to do whatever we could to humiliate the Messiah before we killed him. There's something so wrong and twisted in that, that it speaks to not only the depths of how we can be off before God, but also the greatness of what he can do in our life. Now, I want to go to Mark chapter 15 and talk about his crucifixion. Mark chapter 15, starting at verse 21. Then they compelled a certain man, Simon, a Cyrenian, the father of Alexander and Rufus, as he was coming out of the country and passing by, to bear his cross. And they brought him to the place Golgotha, which is translated place of a skull. Then they gave him wine mingled with myrrh to drink, but he did not take it. When Jesus was led away for crucifixion, we assume that it was done in the normal Roman way, which, first of all, they did not take the most direct route to the place of crucifixion. They did sort of meandering route along a few streets or whatever because they wanted people to see this. Normally speaking, and again, all we can speak about is the normal practices of crucifixion. You know that in everyday life, things depart from the norm. So I can tell you what the normal practice was and say this was probably how it was. Probably, Jesus did not carry the entire cross. You know, the horizontal beam and the vertical beam. Because normally, the Romans left the vertical beam there at the place of crucifixion. The condemned man only carried the horizontal beam. And even so, it was still probably at least 100 pounds for him to carry. So Jesus is carrying the single beam there to the place of the cross. And as he carries it, he has around his neck a title. Because what they would do is they would write out the name and the crime of the accused. And they would have a herald speak it out as they made their way along. But they would hang it around. Once they got to the place of crucifixion, they would put that at the top of the cross, and that would be the title. They make their way through, and as Jesus is going, what happens? He stumbles and falls and can't get up. What did they do? They forced a man to carry the cross for Jesus. And when you think about it, it's fascinating. They didn't force a local to do this. Now, the street's surrounded with locals because this is horrible, but it's a spectacle. It's like a car crash. You don't want to look, but you can't turn away. And so they're inspecting this as it goes by. And as the Roman centurion notices Jesus stumbled and unable to go any further with the cross, he says, if I pick one of these Jewish locals, that could start a riot. I can't afford a riot this Passover time. We're trying to keep things as calm as possible. Who can I pick? I'll pick a tourist. Nobody will mind if I pick a tourist. And so he looks and he picks a man, Simon the Cyrenian, who is from North Africa. Some people speculate that he was black. He was probably of darker complexion. He probably wasn't Negro. He's probably of darker complexion. But he looks around the crowd and he says, that face sticks out to me. You're a tourist. You carry the cross. And I don't think Simon could have been happy about it at the time. But did you notice something? Did you see that verse there? What was it? Mark chapter 15, verse 21. They compelled a certain man, Simon, a Cyrenian, the father of Alexander and Rufus. Now, why would Mark mention that? Isn't that a strange thing? Why would Mark mention such a thing? Does it not indicate for us that surely Mark's original readers knew who Alexander and Rufus were? I mean, if you're mentioning a guy nobody knows, Simon the Cyrenian, what good is it to mention two more guys that nobody knows? If you want to identify him, you identify him in reference to two people that you would know. Now, if the earliest readers of Mark's gospel knew who Alexander and Rufus were, it's very likely an indication that Alexander and Rufus were believers. And if Alexander and Rufus, the sons of Simon the Cyrenian, were believers, can anybody guess where they might have heard about the faith of Jesus Christ? Probably from their dad. Isn't it an amazing thing to think that it's likely, I'm not saying it's certain, but it's likely that that man who literally carried the cross of Jesus Christ, later listened to Jesus' words, take up your cross and follow me. If there is anybody who could say, I know what that verse is all about, that was Simon the Cyrene. They go to the place of crucifixion. They finally make it there, verse 22, to the place Golgotha, which means Calvary. Some people think it was called Golgotha because it was littered with the skulls of men previously executed. I think that's unlikely, but it's possible. Some think it was called Golgotha because it was on a hill that looked like a skull, with the shadows of a skull's face evident in the hillside. Some people think it was called Golgotha because the hill was barren and smooth and round like the top of a skull. But when Jesus came there, they gave him a stupefying drug to drink. And notice what it says in verse 23 of Mark 15. He did not take it. Jesus refused any drug that would numb the pain. He wanted to face the agony of the cross with a clear mind, not medicated in any way. Now, please understand this. Jesus did not do this because he loved suffering. Jesus did this because he loved souls, not because he loved suffering. And he did this for two reasons. The suffering that Jesus endured was actually part of the atonement, so that he would give it all. He would receive it all. But the suffering was also to perfect his character as our merciful high priest who can sympathize with us in all of our sufferings. It's almost as if Jesus said this, is this an aspect of suffering that human beings might, that other, let me say this, is this an aspect of suffering that my fellow human beings might endure? Yes, then I will endure it. I will take it. Take away the drug. I'm going to go into this unmedicated. So Mark chapter 15, verse 24 says this, and when they crucified him, they divided his garments, casting lots for them to determine what every man should take. Now it was the third hour, and they crucified him. And the inscription of his accusation was written above, the King of the Jews. You think of it, there below the cross, Jesus can hear soldiers laughing as they gamble over his clothes. His last meager possession on earth is being gambled over by soldiers who take it as a point of entertainment. I gotta say, I'm almost most sympathetic to these Roman soldiers. For them, it was just a job. They were just doing what they were told to do. Pilate, oh, he's guilty. The religious leaders, absolutely they're guilty. Judas, no doubt about it. But these soldiers, they're just doing what they should do. Not what they should do morally, but what they've been ordered to do. But they crucified him. I want you to notice, nowhere in the Bible do we have a detailed explanation of Jesus' physical agony on the cross. All it says is they crucified him. Now, why? I think there's a few reasons for this. First of all, in the original readers of the biblical accounts, everybody knew what crucifixion was like. Crucifixion by this time had existed for 300 or 400 years. It was invented by the Persians. And it seems that they invented it because they wanted to execute people, but they wanted to honor the god of the earth. So they wanted to lift the person up from the earth while they were killed. So they want to execute a person, make it painful, but they don't want them to die on the ground. So they would lift them up from the earth. The Persians invented it, some people say, between 300 and 400 BC. The Romans perfected it, and they used it as an instrument of torture again and again and again. Now, if the victim in a crucifixion did not die quickly enough, they would break the legs. And crucifixion lasted in the Roman world until Constantine banned it in 337. Now, enlightened Romans considered crucifixion to be beneath civilized society. Matter of fact, there were campaigns to eliminate crucifixion. Just like we might have social campaigns in our own day and age, there was a society, Roman society, to eliminate crucifixion because they thought it was just too barbaric. Matter of fact, a few quotes. Cicero said this: "It is a crime to bind a Roman citizen, to scourge him is an act of wickedness, to execute him is almost murder. What shall I say of crucifying him? It is an act so abominable, it is impossible to find any word adequately to express." In another place, Cicero said this: "The very word cross should be far removed, not only from the person of a Roman citizen, but from the thoughts and eyes and ears of a Roman citizen." Now, the Jews reviled the cross for another reason. The Romans, they hated it, regarded it a torture fit only for slaves. The Jews reviled the cross because they considered it a tree in the sense of Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 23. Let me read this verse to you. Deuteronomy 21, verse 23, it says this: "His body shall not remain overnight on the tree, but you shall surely bury him that day, so that you do not defile the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. For he who is hanged is accursed of God." Now, this probably in Deuteronomy has reference to somebody who's executed by strangulation around the neck, someone who hangs from a tree in that manner. But the Jews of Jesus' day also applied it to the victims of crucifixion. And so it was a double horror. It was a horror to the Romans. It was a horror to the Jews because they considered the one crucified under a special curse from God. And that's why early Christians were so mocked for believing in a crucified Savior. It is difficult for us to imagine how early Christians were thought to be ridiculous because we serve and honor and worship a Savior who died on a cross. Matter of fact, there's this most remarkable graffiti that they found on the walls of Rome. It's in a museum somewhere in Italy now. But this graffiti is remarkable for what it shows. It shows us a picture on a cross. Now, on the one side you see in the picture is the original, but then it's clarified on the other side. And this is what it says: "Alexemnos worships his God." And it's a graffiti mocking Christians because his God is on a cross and his God has a donkey's head. What a fool Alexemnos is because he worships his God, a crucified weirdo. That's from the early days of Christianity. No, we've sanitized the cross since then, but it still exists as a horrific instrument of torture. I'm tempted, but I'm going to avoid the temptation to go into the physical and medical aspects of what happens to a person when they're crucified. But if you were to send me an email, you could do it through my church email address. If you send me an email, I'll send you, or maybe we'll just put up a link, to a remarkable article that was written in 1986 in the Journal of American Medicine, the Journal of the American Med Association, that prestigious medical journal. Dr. William Edwards wrote a remarkable piece called "On the Physical Death of Jesus Christ." And in that article, he powerfully, from a doctor's medical perspective, takes apart what happened to a person when they were crucified. Email me and I'll send you a PDF of that document. It's a remarkable, remarkable article. Now, it is very significant to remember that Jesus suffered all this not as the victim of circumstances. He was in complete control. I never forget what Jesus said in John chapter 10, verse 18. "No one takes my life from me, but I lay it down of myself." Jesus did it voluntarily. Now, it would be horrible for somebody to undergo that torture by compulsion, but Jesus did it out of choice. The other thing I want us to remember, and we'll close with this, the worst suffering of Jesus on the cross was not physical. We understand by what the Bible tells us about what happened on the cross, the worst suffering Jesus endured on the cross was spiritual. When he cried out in agony, quoting from Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? It wasn't just about the physical torture he underwent. It was about the spiritual affliction he endured on the cross as he became the rightful target for all the sin and judgment and guilt and shame that should be upon us, but he took it upon his shoulders. That was the worst suffering. That's another reason why I think the Bible gives us no detailed description of what the sufferings of Jesus were on the cross, physically speaking. It more emphasizes what he went through spiritually, because that's the more significant aspect. And why did he do it? Listen, I don't think you can really appreciate the cross unless you understand why Jesus went to the cross. There's a one-word answer to that. Love. There is no other answer. Love. It's been said, it's a little bit of a, you know, trite saying, but there's truth to it. I don't mind saying it. Nails did not keep Jesus on the cross. Love did. That's what kept him on the cross to the end of it all. Until at the end, he knew that he accomplished everything. He pronounced those glorious words, paid in full, tetelestai, it is finished. And he yielded up his spirit unto